Up here, I got a chair so I don't tower over you while I'm talking to you. Because it's easier to do a story if you have some things to tell stories about. Now, oh, I got some more. Okay. Did you know that there are things that you understand better than adults do, the big people? And some people who write stories, like, have any of you seen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Or some of those other movies? Yeah. You know, the person who wrote those stories, he understood very well that kids, like you, understand some things better than when you get older. And that's good, because I need your help to look at some things that we're going to be talking about later with the big people. But I think some of this stuff you can probably figure out better than they can. They used to know it, and they might have forgotten it. So anyway, I did bring some rocks, but unlike what Pastor Borman said, I'm not going to be throwing them at you. But I do need you to help me with them. I brought along some other gadgets, so I'll try these things out. And I got a hammer here. All geologists have a hammer. This is for keeping the rocks in line. So take a look at these. Have a look at them. Pass them around. And I got a question for you. Some of these are really cool. This has got a magnet in it. Look. Some rocks let magnets stick to them. This one's kind of cool, too. Oh, and they're all a little wet. That's partly because I washed the spiders off them. And partly because it means you don't have to lick them. And generally, licking them, you can see more interesting stuff in the rocks. So anyway, here we go. Here's one. Catch. Ooh, threw a rock. Okay, now here's the skill testing question. Are these rocks real?
Yes.
How do you know they're real? Do you want to borrow a hammer, try hitting one? They feel real? Any other reasons? Yeah.
Because they look real.
They look real. You can see them. Yes, they're heavy. They got some weight to them. And they smell like dirt. Any other reason? There's a whole bunch of reasons why you're pretty sure they're real. But let me ask you about something else. Do any of you think or know that your mother loves you? You do? Only one of you. Oh, two of you. Good, good. Three, four. Maybe some others of you know your mom loves you or your dad loves you? Yeah? Is that real? It is real, isn't it? But, you know, it's not something like the rock that you can pick up, that you can smell, that you can see, that's got some weight to it. It's real, but it's completely different. So I need a couple of... How many people here turn lights on and off when they're at home? Oh, most of you do? Yeah, I need a volunteer, or even two volunteers. Okay. Got lots of volunteers. Could you turn out the lights in here for me, please? Go for it. Yes, that'd be perfect. And I'll need another volunteer right after this. Someone else who's good with lights. We'll get to that in a minute. Oh, that's right. They turned off. Excellent. Could turn them back on again? Come back up here. And just come up here because I want to introduce you. What's your name, by the way?
Valerie.
Valerie? Valerie must be a prophet. Because you just went over there, you flicked a couple of switches, and the lights went on and off. How did you know that was going to happen? Unless you're, of course, a prophet.
Because it's electricity.
It's electricity. I don't see anything connecting the switches and the lights. How did you know it was going to work with the electricity?
I don't know.
It just did? You've seen it happen before? Cool. Thanks. And now, anybody, any ideas? Why did that work? Yes. Yes. But how does the electricity get from that switch up to these lights? Does it just fly through the air? Yes?
Through wires?
Oh, through wires. I've seen wires. I used to do stuff with wires when I was a little bit older than you. I used to make stuff, take it apart. It didn't work afterwards, but, you know. Okay, so there's wires, and they're hidden. I guess they must be in the ceiling and in the wall or something like that. All right, well, I brought some more tools. Did somebody else want to help turn off the lights? I don't know what you're going to need here, but I got some pliers. These are good for cutting wires. And they've got a screwdriver and some other stuff. So do you want to go turn off the lights? Here you go. There you go.
Hold them and then turn off the light?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, that's easy.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. Turn it back on again. Okay, I think that was very wise of you. You didn't use these tools to turn the lights off, did you? You didn't cut a hole in the wall and then go find the wires and cut them. Okay, yeah, okay. You know what? This is just like things that are real. We have mothers and fathers who love us. Maybe you have brothers and sisters who love you as well, but sometimes that's harder to tell. But you know what? All of this is held together by wiring. Did you know you have wiring in you? There's real wiring in you. It's called nerves. You'd have to find a doctor here who could explain that more. I'm a geologist. I work with rocks. They don't have nerves. But God also wires things. He wires our parents to us. He wires our friends to us. And it's important to understand that things that are real might not be things that we can pick up and touch, but they're just as important and they're just as real. And it's also worth learning, is it right to use these kinds of tools? Or is there a better way of turning things on and off? And that's the same with our friends and our families. So when you are doing things with your mom and dad, remember, these aren't the right kind of tools for working with your friends or your parents. There's better ways of working with that wiring. And it's real, okay? Thanks for your help. Can I have my rocks back? Okay. Christopher, you have a job. So if you would like to follow along, but to tell you the truth, sometimes I find it harder to follow along. If somebody reads from another translation, it can create more problems when you follow along. So by all means, crack open your Bibles to Mark chapter 10. And if you don't follow along, at least it's ready to look at later. Jesus left the region and went to the districts of Judea around the Jordan. A large crowd gathered around him, and once more, as his custom was, he taught them. Some Pharisees approached him with a question. "Is it permitted," they asked, "for a man to divorce his wife?" They said this to trap him. "Well," answered Jesus, "what did Moses command you?" "Moses permitted us," they replied, "to write a notice of separation and so to complete the divorce." "He gave you that command," said Jesus, "because you are hard-hearted. But from the beginning of creation, male and female, he made them. And that's why the man must leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, so that the two become one flesh." There you are, then. They are no longer two, but one flesh. What God has joined, humans must not split up. When they were back indoors, the disciples asked him about this. "Anyone who divorces his wife," says Jesus, "and marries someone else commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries someone else, she commits adultery." To carry on with that introduction that I had from Pastor Dave here. And I have to say, when I printed this thing out yesterday, it came out at 14 pages. I'm looking at this going, 14 pages, that's way too long. Fortunately, I did this in a word processor, so I could quickly change the font size from 14 to 12. Now it's only 9 pages. There are two roles where I'm involved in speaking to groups. One is as a cadet instructor. Many of you know that I have a role in the military. My military occupation is basically youth group leader with the Canadian Cadet Organization. Some of you will know this because we've talked about things. Some of you will know it because you've seen me in uniform if there happens to be a Sunday when I'm immediately going to something that's on duty. For example, in September, we have the Battle of Britain Sunday where there's a wing parade. A number of you will have seen me in uniform and wondered, what on earth is he doing? In the type of speaking I do there, I lose marks if I stand behind a podium and don't move around. We are taught to interact with the audience to maintain focus, read discipline, monitor learning, and reinforce points by engaging individuals. I'll try not to do that too much, as I'm not sure it's completely appropriate here, but maybe it's not that inappropriate. The other role in which I tend to speak is as a geologist. And in that role, I'm giving presentations in boardrooms or giving a paper at a conference. I'll try to avoid talking about rocks. We did that. And when we're doing those kinds of talks, particularly the ones where we're giving a presentation at a conference, we begin with a disclaimer. In Canada, the disclaimer is the qualified person, which is usually me who's giving the talk, accepts responsibility for everything I'm going to say. And if there's a problem, then I guess it's me, the company's off the hook. When we do the presentations in the U.S., they have a different disclaimer, which is mostly legal mumbo-jumbo and boils down to, what I'm about to say may not be true and cannot be relied upon to predict the future stock prices of any companies involved. I certainly don't want to start that way. But I do want to say that I have very little personal experience with what appears to be the main subject of this passage. Growing up, going through school, I had no direct experience with divorce in my family or with families that we were friends with, or I don't even remember any of my friends at school having this kind of situation. Where I first became introduced to the effects of divorce was working with cadets. I spent quite a number of years working as an administration officer, among other positions, and since then I've been working as a commanding officer. And in both those positions, you learn remarkably quickly how many complicated families there are that you're dealing with. And I would be dealing with the children in these complicated families. And you quite quickly also learn how to recognize and deal with some of the games that are played between members of the family, including the kids. So I earnestly hope that nothing I say appears to be insensitive to anyone here who's had more direct contact with divorce. That's certainly not the intention. The initial response to reading this passage, and I would have to admit, for me at least, if I was reading this, say, as a piece of a daily devotion, I would be tempted to look at this passage, go, oh yeah, okay, this is pretty straightforward stuff. I've read it before, and relegated almost to a position similar to a chunk of genealogies or a list of who were all the families who were involved in the temple or returning from exile. And probably, I would hate to say, give it not much more consideration than those passages. So the initial response to, what's the impact of this message for West Coast? How important is it? Might be not very much. In the 13 or 14 years, I couldn't quite figure out how many years we'd been here, that our family has been at West Coast. And we're getting out of the newcomer stage now, so we're starting to feel like we fit in. I cannot recall a single conversation where someone trivialized divorce or marriage. So there's no question in my mind. I believe that we treat both of those as being very important and significant subjects. So in addition to that, the passage seems to have limited application to West Coast because it's really only addressing members who are married. Maybe it's giving some advance warning to singles, but a significant number of everybody here is single. So how can this passage be of much relevance to someone who's not married? Before we relegate this passage, though, I think we should take a look back and see what's actually happening in the passage. I personally enjoy reading about and watching programs on history and archaeology. In fact, this seems to be a common interest in our family. Although we might have different individual focuses as to what parts of history and archaeology are interesting, we do enjoy learning about that because it can bring some real life to places we visit, or in this case, perhaps a passage we're reading. You don't really realize, though, how much your boys are picking up on the archaeology programs until we watch another program where some archaeological faux pas is taking place, and you hear screams of, oh, that's wrong, they just don't do it that way, which is always encouraging to know that something's being learned in these things. I find in particular in studying Bible passages that history and archaeology can really bring them to life. We can absolutely read many of these passages without looking into the history, but sometimes the history will incredibly reinforce and enliven points which are in there. With history and related fields, we can also easily make the assumption about the context and the groups involved that they are just like us. We assume too much that they're similar and that we don't take into account the differences. We can also assume that they are completely different from us, that we have nothing in common. And both of those can be mistakes. In my geological work, we spend a significant amount of time working on community relations. This is an important issue for us because the way we represent ourselves when we work in small communities is quite important. And when you work overseas, where there's another language, people look different, they talk different, the houses look different, everything's different, you expect the culture to be different. And you're often surprised with how similar it is. When you are working in North America, where we have a common language, the houses look kind of similar. We look kind of similar sometimes. It's easy to underestimate how much difference there can be between communities. So I've come across both of these cases where we overestimate or underestimate the differences. So, having given you that little warning of things to look for, and there may be much about the ancient Middle East which is not so different from the Middle East today. Some things have definitely changed, but there may be characteristics about the culture which are remarkably similar. So having given you this little heads up, let's start looking at the historical context. One source that I go to, which I find quite approachable, is somebody by the name of Tom Wright. He writes quite a bit of stuff. I read, I'm pretty sure this was just his translation. This is a commentary of his. I'm pretty sure what I was reading was his own translation of the passage, which is probably why it didn't match with any of yours. Tom Wright is an internationally renowned New Testament scholar and historian. He is an expert in both. He's a very good communicator, and he brings both of these things together so that the history augments the theology work he does and the theology he integrates back into his work with history. So I find that he's a really good source to go to because his area of expertise is history of the New Testament period. His credibility is also enhanced, in my view, because he's a loyal supporter of Newcastle United. And in one of his books, one of his commentaries, I believe it's the Parable of the Good Samaritan, he redescribes in terms of black and white and red and white jerseys. Now, for anybody in the northeast of England, and most English in general, will immediately grasp the significance of the red and white and the black and white jerseys. And for that, I think that's a brilliant way of describing that story so that it's going to work in the schoolyard. They will get it. Yes. As with many stories, the one that we're looking at here, the passage we're looking at here, has more than one layer. So what is the layer that everybody got when they heard it a couple of millennia ago from Jesus in Judea? We know the question, we're told the question, was specifically given as a test. But what exactly was being tested, and what was a passing mark? So, talking about divorce is a lot like talking about marriage. Divorce being the absence or the destruction of marriage. And a few years earlier, from when this was being spoken, someone else had been teaching in Judea around the Jordan and had gotten into trouble for publicly criticizing the unusual marriage relationships of Herod. If you want to roll back into where we've looked at that earlier, you'll find that written in Mark 6. Such criticism would not normally have been a problem to basically stand up because this was within Jewish law and have a really firm line on marriage and divorce. But in this case, it was about Herod Antipas and his current wife, Herodias. Both were divorced, and Herodias had previously been married to Herod Philip, the half-brother of Herod Antipas. She had initiated divorce with Herod Philip. That made it illegal under Jewish law, as John the Baptist and many others seem to be pointing out. This was an embarrassment to Herodias. It seems even more so than to Herod Antipas. And we read the details of John's imprisonment and eventual murder resulting from a trap by Herodias. There's quite a few Herods around. Herods in the New Testament era are a bit like Louis in French history and Ptolemies in the Greek period of Egyptian history. There's an awful lot of them, and it takes a bit to separate them out. So just a quick comment on that. Herod Antipas should not be confused with the original Herod, of what I understand is the original Herod, Herod the Great. He's associated with many archaeological sites in Jerusalem, around Palestine, and also outside of Palestine. he was... a whole other story. He was not Jewish. He was of Moabite descent. But he had a strange attraction to Judaism and used his marriage to a Jewess to attempt to legitimize his descendants as potential heirs to a Jewish throne to be true kings of Israel. All that having happened not too long ago, and the incident with John the Baptist being imprisoned had only happened a few years ago when Jesus has returned to this place. So it's not in distant memory. It's clearly within the memory. It would not have been very difficult to have people who wanted to remove Jesus from his ministry see that there was potentially a very attractive win-win situation developing here, at least from the point of view of removing Jesus from the scene. Ask Jesus a question about the subject that got John into trouble, and whatever he says, he's going to be in trouble. It's a pretty carefully constructed trap in that sense. If he answers the way John the Baptist would have, report him as a treasonous upstart, and have Herod or Herodias finish him off. If Jesus answers in a more liberal answer, then as teachers of the law, they can denounce him as a false teacher. So what's not to like about this trap? How can he get out of it? If there's any question that this agenda is not being picked up by the people present, not just Jesus, but everyone who's sitting around listening to the teaching and the Pharisees, this is dispelled by the clarification that the disciples receive once they're inside in private. What agenda do you answer, yours or theirs? It seems that the title on this section might have been a little bit misleading. The teaching that's going on here, we don't actually know too much about what Jesus taught. Because the pattern goes teaching. We're told there was some teaching. He goes into the Jordan area, teaches. Then there's a question or answer period. And then there's another question or answer period. The fact that the answer to the first question is not, what did I just teach about? We can be pretty sure that whatever Jesus taught, it was not previously about divorce. But going back to this question and issue of how do we answer questions with integrity, I don't mean to trivialize this question either. I'm well aware that there are people here who were born or have lived outside Canada, some of whom may have been in the same situation or a similar situation, not unlike what Jesus was in, where you are presented with a challenging question that is difficult to answer with integrity, so that your safety is not jeopardized unnecessarily, but you also answer the question truthfully. Around the time of the 11 September attacks, I was briefed as a Canadian Forces member on how to respond to questions from media. I think I had 3 briefings over the course of a couple of months. And I came across a wallet-sized card that we were given at the time with points on both sides about how to handle media. Our superiors clearly wanted to be quite sure that we were able to answer questions. And at the same time, they did not issue a general order saying, no comment, you can't speak. Refusing to answer a question can be interpreted in many ways by whoever asked the question. So no comment is to be avoided at all costs. That was one thing that we were made clear. I don't know is not bad. It's much better than no comment, because it might be showing a sign of weakness, but it's not leaving the door open for a lot of other interpretations. Although as CIC officers, cadet instructor cadre officers working with cadets, we're not likely to have much profound to say on the subject. And believe me, we don't guard a lot of Canada's secrets. We are some of the most visible Canadian Forces members because we work in many communities across Canada where there are no regular force or reserve force units. And for those of you who've seen me in uniform, how many other Canadian Forces member have you seen in uniform? I mean, we have a small military here. There's not many going around that you see from day to day, unless you live in the right place. So we are the most widely spread, visible members of the Canadian Forces, but at the same time, we have the least formal military training. Another problem, which was discussed in this briefing, was that some of the questions we might be asked would have an alternate agenda that we were not aware of. Most of us had very few opportunities to use or think about the cards in our wallets. I think I had two conversations where the items on the wallet, on the card in the wallet, came into play. And one of them was one of the strangest conversations I've ever had with the media. And to this day, I'm still wondering if, in fact, they were the media. Jesus turns the situation that he's in completely around by answering the question through the mouths of the people who are asking it. This avoided anything specific about Herod or Herodias, since it's unlikely that the Pharisees asking the question were about to bring up the subject. He further reinforced the answer by changing the subject from divorce to marriage, which is the flip side of the coin. He reinforces his answer also by referring to earlier Moses. So what the Pharisees had quoted him was perfectly legitimate. They knew their Bible, so to speak. And they were quoting him quite correctly. But what Jesus does is he goes back to earlier, more fundamental law and Moses. By going on to an earlier principle, he's pointing out a principle that is more fundamental than this exception, this allowance, which the Pharisees are talking about. Later, the disciples, who I think pretty much understood what was going on with this question, when they get back to the house, when they're back in the mess, to use the military analogy, they ask for clarification. Because here, and the way Tom Wright translates it, is once they're indoors, they're no longer outside, nobody's overhearing them, they can go up and say, okay, we heard what you said, now what's the real deal? Okay? And maybe they were wondering, that wasn't the same answer that John the Baptist would have given. He would have called a spade and come right out and said it. We know where it got him. But maybe they were curious as to, why is your answer different from what John the Baptist had to say? They understood the danger of the original test question, but they wanted to know a bit more. The answer they get is consistent with the original answer that the Pharisees received. Jesus has not changed his answer, but he has added a detail in verse 12 that puts Herodias in the frame without naming her. Within Jewish law, under certain circumstances, a husband could initiate divorce. I found a range of references about marriage divorce practices of other cultures of that time. And while some may have had similar views to the Jews in Palestine, there were definitely other cultures that they were in contact with who did not, and in which marriage was a much more lightly entered situation. And divorce could be initiated by both men and women and was relatively accessible. And two cultures where that seems to be the case, and I must say I found a lot of conflicting notes on what the what marriage and divorce and whatnot was about in the ancient world. So if somebody's looking for a high school project, you might find a lot of material there that would be interesting to work through. But Egypt and Rome are both cultures and countries which had a lot of influence in the Palestine area at that time, and both of them permitted divorce, and it was not considered a big deal. And by saying that, that also means marriage, except for its potential for political gains, was not considered a big deal either. But the pattern of remarriage, which was acceptable to Rome, was not acceptable to Jewish law. It's pretty hard to see how the pattern that is used in that answer could have been mistaken by the people who were listening as anything other than a comment about Herodias and her situation specifically. So perhaps the section heading could be changed to answering questions with integrity. And now this message is not restricted to questions about divorce. It will come up with any subject where there's a difference between what we are taught by Scripture and what is believed to be right and true, and I do mean believed to be right and true, by the secular culture around us. Or it might actually be the religious culture around us as well, depending on where we are. Questions with subtly hidden agendas can be used as traps in public, or they may come from individuals who have experienced some hurt or injustice in their past, which they see as being related to what you stand for. If you are wearing, in a different analogy, the uniform of a Christian. So I get asked questions because I'm in uniform. I'm visibly different when I'm in uniform. If you are living as we are taught as a community of believers, you will be visibly different, but not because of a uniform. But you'll still be visibly different. Although this took a little historical digging, which I liked, to find out how historical context adds to the passage, I think that at the time it was likely very clear, both to Jesus and the disciples, where the questions were heading. Not all questions. Not all questions we might be called on to answer have a clear hidden meaning. Discernment is needed to find out if there is an underlying issue. Although if that situation is suspected, sometimes something as simple as, what are you really getting at, will open up the conversation. I also came across quite a few quotes and references to unqualified divorce statistics, none of which I'm using here, none of which I'm using anywhere in here, because I couldn't find any which had really any concrete meaning. It was a number. Numbers mean nothing unless you can understand how that number was arrived at. I wouldn't do that anymore if I was giving a geological talk and I had some completely unsubstantiated gold grade. Even if it's a nice big number, what does it mean? If there's no control in the number, it means nothing. And about the only thing I can say is that from the statistics and what I saw, there's quite a bit of divorce around. So that was one of the messages that seemed to be coming out of this passage, was the importance of integrity and answering questions. Then I want to move on to another small part of the passage, which I think was actually particularly new and interesting. And this gets into quoting the law rather than, or as well as, interpreting the law. First of all, let's just step back a little bit and ask, what is law? Both the original question and Jesus' response refer to the books of Moses, first five books of the Bible, also known as the law or the law of Moses. Law is a term we use daily, and it has several different meanings. Laws can be restrictive, don't do this. They can be prescriptive, do this, or only do this. And they can be descriptive. This is how it is. Within the law of Moses, we have all three characteristics, which is important to note. I'll explain that a bit more. Our modern use of law really only has the first two. The third, that's the one that the descriptive law, we most often encounter today in things like the laws of physics, or the laws of nature, as they're sometimes called. And the fact they are still commonly referred to as laws in science is a real source of frustration to the Dawkins of the world and other anti-theistic scientists, since law implies purpose or cause. And it's a bit annoying to feel that physics or chemistry or mathematics has a purpose for them. So the idea of purpose does not fit at all well with their understanding of the big picture of how things work. In the military, certainly in the cadet part, it seems that the majority of regulations are written, and these are laws, are written to deal with something that went wrong. You know you've been around a long time, maybe too long, when you start to recognize regulations based on the fact that you were there when the thing went wrong and you know what they're talking about. This is a gross simplification of law in the Bible, but it brings out some of the characteristics that I'd like to follow up. Laws are also, they have another property. They are either made or they are discovered. We tend to break that down in our modern society, that laws which are prescriptive or restrictive are the ones that we make. And the ones that we discover are the ones that science are involved in, discovering laws of physics, laws of nature. The law of Moses was revealed to Moses by God. It was discovered. But there are other descriptions where, in the Old Testament, this isn't the law of Moses, but where David and Solomon are involved in making laws, which are restrictive or prescriptive, just like the kind of laws we have nowadays. It's just the same kind of taxes. Now, physical and mathematical laws continue to be discovered today. And sometimes the discoverer is experiencing something which I believe is a lot like revelation in the process. I'm sure Dawkins would also object to that comparison. But I think many other scientists would relate positively to the similarity between scientific discovery and revelation. Let me give you an example of how our thinking about law has been, including, to a large extent, the law of the Bible that's coming out of the Bible, has been seriously influenced by the culture around us. This is going back to a conversation I had many years ago. I can't remember the context or exactly who else was involved in it. And it was a discussion on the nature of rights, in particular human rights. And one of the people involved in this conversation was a Jewish student. By student, I'm talking about he's gone on to significant advanced study as a Jewish scholar. And he basically came out and jumped into the middle of the conversation on rights and said, "You guys in the West have got it totally backwards." Says, human rights have nothing to do with what you can make. They're only what you can discover. Anything you make is just a fabrication. But rights come out of discovering what the rights are in the law. And it really shortened the conversation, because the point he was making was something that the rest of us had not really thought about before. Is that there are some of these kinds of things that we're dealing with, which are important issues. I mean, we could be in all kinds of contexts where something about this big area of human rights comes up. And the point he made is, this is something that was created into the world that we live in. It's not something that we create. So that's an example of how we have changed our way of thinking about rights to fit with the secular understanding of law around us. The whole interaction between the Pharisees and Jesus, from my understanding, my limited understanding as an armchair historian, follows a pretty typical kind of pattern for a scholarly discussion. The two sides are quoting from the law of Moses to make their side. And then Jesus moves on from his quote from Genesis, the earlier law, the more fundamental law, that what God has brought together. And he then goes on to make a comment. The comment being, in verse 9. I think the quote from the law ends just a little bit before that, but verse 9 is, "What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." Now, this comment coming after the quote from the law could be doing two things. It could be restating what's in there just for clarity. Here's another way of phrasing that point in the law. Or it could be explaining an underlying principle that is fundamental even to this law. I did search through the Old Testament as well as I could, and I hope someone will correct me afterwards if I'm wrong, but I could not find somewhere in there where this verse seemed to be alluded to or was being quoted. I know they are sometimes difficult to find, but I couldn't find this. So this seems to me to be where Jesus is clarifying this point, and I believe making an underlying statement about what's going on there. And that's important. The underlying statement is important. It's an underlying principle, sorry. First, it seems to add significantly to what is being quoted in Moses. God joined together, not man. That's a bit more information than we had in Moses. God has been involved in joining together the marriage. This is substantially different from any secular view and many religious views we will find around us today. But in addition to this, if this is an underlying principle, what else has God joined that follows the same principle? God has joined us together in relationships. This is an important one, very important one, by joining us together in the relationship of marriage. But it's not the only one that gets mentioned. Children and parents are, well, children are knitted together. Psalm 113 is one of the places where that image is used. So God is directly involved in our individual creation. And as a result of that, in joining us to our parents. Divorce doesn't directly make it into the Ten Commandments, but the fifth commandment is regarding the relationship between children and their parents. So this is not a trivial relationship. This is definitely something God has knitted the child together. There is a relationship which is God made between the children and the parent. And something which I found quite interesting was when Tom Wright is making his commentary on the passage on divorce, he notes that the immediate following passage, which I'm pretty sure I wasn't supposed to cover, deals with children and bringing children to Jesus. And he makes a comment that this proximity is not coincidental, that there's a special care that Jesus has for the children. And this is beside the passage on divorce. Because as I found out when I worked with cadets, that sometimes the most widespread effect that you come across regarding divorce is through the children. So Tom Wright notes the fact that the passage about the children immediately follows the passage on divorce. Interesting comment. What are some other relationships? Another relationship that comes up in a number of places, probably more so, or I think more so in the New Testament, is the relationship with our neighbor. Now, I believe those relationships are as much directed by God as they are of our own making. So our neighbor is, maybe we have some control, but I think everybody can probably think of instances where a contact, a situation that they've been in, seems to have been way beyond their control and seems to have been something that God has put you in with your neighbor. So I believe that included in things joined together by God are our relationships with our neighbors. Christopher and I watched an interesting show a couple of weeks ago on the 6 degrees of separation, which you may have heard. It was a popular subject 10 years ago. There was a bit of a game on the internet which was about the 6 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon, and that you could connect Kevin Bacon to any other actor in Hollywood through the movies they've been in together with no more than 6 degrees of separation. Now, Kevin Bacon, and certainly not Kevin Bacon, and he would be the first to admit this, but that was not invented for that game. The 6 degrees of separation actually goes back to a study or a paper written in the 1930s, I believe it was, by a statistician who made a comment that is often converted into you're only 6 handshakes away from everybody in the world. I don't know if that was true at the time of Jesus. I suspect it wasn't. But I think there's very good evidence that it is today. One of the things which we learned in this program we were watching that makes it work and is very important to this only 6 degrees of separation or less is the fact that there are now hubs. The importance of the church, Big C Church, in making hubs cannot be underestimated. In terms of making neighbors, the church is one of the most successful organizations in the world. Looking around this room, knowing people who are in West Coast, I think you have 1 degree of separation from every continent except for Antarctica, but we won't worry about that one. Okay? So the church has a very high degree of connectivity around the world through very few people. That is, well, what I'm thinking about as a scientist, that's actually astonishing. That's an incredible fact that we can really be 6 or less handshakes separated from anybody else of the 6.9 billion people in this world from this room. So the passages we have in the New Testament about who is your neighbor, I think have changed. I think have changed drastically, so that the who is our neighbor is a much larger scope. We have no excuse anymore for not seeing any part of the world as being connected to our neighborhood. Let's move on to another one. And this is a very important analogy because it is used repeatedly in the Bible to describe God's relationship with us. All of these are used. The relationship of children and parents. God is our Father, so the relationship between children and parents is an important analogy of our relationship to God. But this one is even more important, not only because it relates more closely to the subject today, and that is the relationship of the church as the body of Christ and the bride of Christ. From the Old Testament on, if you look in Isaiah 62, Jeremiah 2, and Hosea 2, the image of marriage is associated with God's relationship to his people. And the problems in marriage is related to the problems in the relationship between God and his people. In the New Testament, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, this is in Matthew 25, and Paul in Corinthians, later in Ephesians, and then John in Revelation, use the image of the bride of Christ. Unlike the other relationships, the parents, our neighbors, this relationship continues beyond this life. Following the imagery, the bride of Christ, the church, therefore, cannot be divorced because we're on the side of the relationship which is not allowed to initiate the divorce, thankfully. And the other side of the relationship is the one who is faithful. So the image and the law that we were hearing about through Moses, if nothing else, should be reinforcing our confidence in the stability and the permanence of our relationship to God through Christ. Because we cannot initiate divorce. We're the bride. So the principle, the underlying principle that Jesus teaches to explain the instructions in Moses on divorce go much further than divorce and open up a window that overlooks many other passages in Scripture. It addresses how we should fundamentally look at the world around us, how we should look at reality, like we were talking about with the kids earlier. That there are things which are just as real as the physical rocks we can pick up. But this, when we were talking earlier about the difficult questions that are going to come up from the society around us, these are things that we believe, but our society is getting further and further away from believing. There have been 3 major projects on understanding reality over the course of human history. The one we are most familiar with is science. This is the youngster of the three. In its form that we know it today, it's only been around for a couple or three centuries. The other two are philosophy and theology. All three are alive and well today, but things are changing. Many of the founders of science, as we know it today, modern science, were very grounded in their faith. Newton wrote more about theology than he wrote about physics. I don't know a lot about his theology. Maybe it wasn't as impressive as his physics, but within Newton's personal life, theology was as important and more important, in fact, than his work with physics. But he's looked at as being one of the main fathers of modern science. Science in the last couple of centuries has been an astonishingly successful project. It has brought us technology, it has brought us medicine, it has brought us a huge range of benefits, including bringing us down to the 6 degrees of separation, which is effectively making the world our neighbor. Why science works so well is a bit of a mystery. And it's a bit of a philosophical briar patch. Most of its followers, most of science followers, have dismissed theology now as any kind of legitimate source of objective truth. Many, including some neo-Darwinists, sorry I'm using terminology here, but for those of you who follow this kind of thing, it's useful, otherwise ignore it. Many, such as neo-Darwinists, have rejected philosophy as well as being able to provide objective truth about reality. That is getting to the point that they're running into trouble there because they haven't noticed that that actually undermines a good part of mathematics, which they probably didn't mean to do. But justification of law and rights within government is now comfortable if it is backed by science, even though it is also recognized that science is changing and developing rapidly. So we are basing our source of understanding on truth and knowledge on something which is changing rapidly. It's interesting. I don't know whether philosophy or theology is older. I don't know if that can be answered. I think it's a bit like in the military, at least in those areas derived from British influence. The Navy is referred to as the senior service and receives the appropriate respect as the senior service. Does that mean there were no armies before there were navies? No. That's not what it means at all. There have been armies around as long as we've had people. But King Alfred formed a national navy many centuries ago. I forgot to look up the date. 800-something, I think. And at that time, all of the armies were privately owned by individual nobles. There was no national standing army. Therefore, the navy was the first nationally formed force. It's the senior service. The other theory is that Navy has the most fashionable and flashy looking uniforms. They look good at the beginning of the parade. So, we need to touch briefly, just as we're wrapping up here, on this philosophy business. Roger Trigg, who's a professor of philosophy at Warwick University, I believe it is, he's a very good writer, very good speaker, and he presents both philosophy and philosophy from a Christian perspective very eloquently. I can highly recommend his books. He's as readable as Tom Wright. He defines philosophers as people who ask annoying questions about things that should be common sense. It's probably not a bad definition. I couldn't find another definition for a theologian, but maybe I can find one later. He also defines common sense as the previous generation's philosophy. That's what's inherited as our common sense. I've really come to appreciate a lot of the points that Roger Trigg brings up when he's being his best annoying philosopher self, because philosophy makes you think about how you're thinking. Philosophy still includes the subject of ethics and morals. It shares some of that with theology, and apparently, from what modern culture says, that is now being taken over by science, which has not traditionally been the jurisdiction of ethics or morals. So, why does our philosophy, how we think about reality, matter? It matters a lot because we act from day to day based on what we know. What we know. What we know about rocks. What we know about things which are physical and real. It influences how we act on what we believe. That my mother loves me. And that is real. Perhaps we could reword a hymn to celebrate the recent success of science. I was thinking of something like, my hope is built on nothing less than science. But I couldn't do the next line because the science kept on changing. Please don't think that the message here is that science is bad and we need to get rid of it. Practice of science is my bread and butter. But through studying scripture, through reading about the philosophy of science, I also question how I do what I do. What's the underlying thing that I'm doing with this science? And what are its limitations? We need all three of these quests for knowledge, quests for reality. Theology is bringing us things which philosophy and science cannot. Philosophy is teaching us, how do we think? Why are we thinking this way? And science speaks for itself. It's been a very successful project. So it's neither good nor bad by itself. But that which God joined together is no less real than what science can study. Some of it is more real in the sense that it will outlast what science can study. Breaking what God has joined together, whether through divorce or damaging other relationships such as parents and children, neighbors, or in the church, is no less damaging to creation than oil spills in the Gulf, deforestation, and many other environmental travesties that you can all name. But it is all part of reality that falls beyond the mandate and scope of the big science project. Because of what we know, because of what we know God has joined together. I've got to put the emphasis on the right word in the sentence. We will end up having to respond to questions designed to trap us, not just from media. It wouldn't hurt us to read this passage as a short lesson on how we can answer those questions following the pattern that Jesus did in a way that will be with integrity and also answering important questions which ultimately will come into areas like ethics in the communities that we live in and that we work in. And that ends page 14.